Your North Carolina Reading Service now presents Indie Week, read by John Federson. And our issues dated January the 13th, 2021, and it's intended for our blind and print-impaired listeners. And once again, combing the area for musicians to perform our theme music, free of charge, we have found the Ars Gratis Ensemble, who submitted this stunning audition tape at their own expense. And they are this week's winners. And their prize, our hearty thank you. And we will put them on hold until the close of today's broadcast. Ours gratis, ladies and gentlemen. And our January 13th issue begins Push League, written by Drew Millard. Oh, my God. That's just about all you can say about January 6th, when, following a pep talk from Donald Trump at his so-called Stop the Steal rally in Washington, D.C., thousands of right-wing psychos breached the door of the Capitol building as lawmakers were going through the largely ceremonial step of ratifying Joe Biden's victory in the Electoral College. I'm not exactly sure what they were attempting to do, really. Intimidate elected officials into handing the presidency back to Trump? Straight up take over the government? Wreak havoc as a show of impotent rage? If it was the third thing they were after, they definitely got it. This past year, we've seen our fair share of violence and property damage at protests, and while I'm not particularly interested in debating the utility of those tactics in furthering a cause such as the Black Lives Matter movement, I want to be clear that it is not ideologically inconsistent to approve of anti-fascist activists smashing a window and then condemn the events of last week, because the battalion of aggrieved skidoo dealers, human Pepe memes, and unapologetic white nationalists running roughshod over the Capitol building cannot be called protesters, as Senator Chuck Schumer, soon-to-be Democratic Majority Leader, put it in a speech on Wednesday night. The more appropriate term, as Schumer saw it, was violent extremists. What happened on January 6th was a planned but failed insurrection. That isn't hyperbole or speculation on my part. There was a Daily Beast story on January 2, which noted that on the pro-Trump subreddit R the Donald, people were distributing maps, charting routes from the Stop the Steal rally directly to Congress, and posting comments like, quote, "We'll storm offices and physically remove and even kill all the D.C. traitors and reclaim the country," unquote. Though the MAGA mob was eventually driven off by law enforcement, given the openly planned nature of the insurrection, the only conclusion a reasonable person can make from the fact that it happened at all is that those responsible for security at and after the rally didn't take the threat seriously, or didn't think that the MAGA crowd, which claims to love law enforcement, would try to rush them. Internal Pentagon memos that were subsequently released show that in the days prior to the rally, Pentagon officials intentionally restricted the National Guard's ability to respond to an emergency, and then were reluctant to authorize the Guard to aid local police when an emergency did occur, which raises a whole other decidedly darker set of theories. When the breach happened, Trump did nothing, or rather, he did worse than nothing. He's literally the one who made it happen. At the rally, told the crowd, "We're going to walk down to the Capitol. We're never going to take back our country with weakness." There were other words between the ones I quoted. But given the plans that some of his supporters had already concocted, this was tantamount to a go signal. While senators, representatives, staff, press, and security barricaded themselves in their chambers and offices with furniture as MAGA chuds banged on the door like extras in a George A. Romero movie, Trump tweeted, These are the things and events that happen when a sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from great patriots who have been badly and unfairly treated for so long. That tweet was deleted, along with another one in which he blamed Vice President Mike Pence for not delivering him the presidency on the Senate floor. Not for nothing were these dips heard screaming, "Where is Pence?" as they smashed their way around the Capitol. That night, Pence gave a speech in front of a reconvened Senate condemning the day's violence and reintroducing the session that would end in a formalized Biden victory. I can't believe I'm typing this, but it seems like the only recourse at this exact moment is to put Pence in charge until Inauguration Day on January 20th. Between him and Trump, he's obviously the best man for the job. Even if Pence sucks, at least we'll know he'll hand over the keys to the car next week. There's no guarantee that Donald Trump will do the same, regardless of the sleepy-eyed, no-talent statement he made on January 7th, assuring us he would. Get him out. Fast-track impeachment proceedings. Invoke the 25th Amendment. Tell him he can host The Apprentice again if he resigns. I don't care how it happens, and neither should you. The night of the insurrection, some of the Republican lawmakers who had previously threatened to derail the counting of the Electoral College votes suddenly changed their tunes in a desperate attempt to backpedal toward a place of decorum. But people like Jim Langford and the recently defeated Kelly Loeffler should have known that if enough powerful people falsely claim an election was stolen enough times, eventually others might try to take that election back through violent means. Maybe Trump's tenure in office was always going to end with the dumbest possible recreation of the storming of the Bastille, and maybe this authoritarian insurrectionist mentality was always present at a not insignificant chunk of the American populace. The only thing I know is that this is a mess, and we'll be cleaning it up long after we're rid of, as Anderson Cooper called him last week on CNN, quote, "a very small man who was once considered the leader of the free world." Tomasi McDonald now weighs in from Durham, chess to checkers. Bruce Bridges used to feed his customers knowledge and fried chicken at his beloved No bookstore in South Durham. Now the owner of the Fayetteville Street property where the bookstore used to stand plans to feed the community hamburgers and fries. Last week, Durham City Council members unanimously approved a $140,000 economic incentive grant to Bookman Commercial Holdings. The Durham-based limited liability company is run by Dobbin Bookman, whose family has deep business ties to the community, including longtime ownership of 2520 Fayetteville Street. In the years since No Bookstore's closure, the McLaughlin family, of which Bookman is a part, ran Coco's Jazz and Cultural Arts Center out of that same storefront. But the business failed to deliver on its promise of black music and culture in a historical black neighborhood. Coco's also stumbled as a recording venue where artists could expect clean, dry vocals at $35 an hour, according to its billboard. The Thursday night specials for nearby North Carolina Central University students never materialized either. Council member Pierce Freeland noted during that session, "The space has been vacant for a while." Bookman is president and owner of Bookman Commercial Holdings, which first registered with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office on June 4, 2020. The extended Bookman family has operated several businesses in the area over the decades, including The Neighborhood, a now-closed small store at the intersection of Fayetteville and Dupree Streets, where NC Central students could purchase snacks and cooked food items between classes. Bookman wants to use the $140,000 in city incentives to demolish the two-story brownstone building and begin construction of a new Checkers fast-food restaurant with walk-up, drive-through, and outdoor seating. At the virtual city council meeting, the thought of the major changes at the site of the former bookstore, which closed in 2010, had council members feeling nostalgic. Bookman's grandmother, 104-year-old Mosella McLaughlin, was once Freeland's babysitter. I grew up in and around that building, he said. I remember being able to get some really good fried chicken at the bookstore back in the day, said Jillian Johnson, the city's mayor pro tempore. Councilmember Mark Anthony Middleton. You couldn't go in the bookstore and not have anybody know you were there no bookstore because it left a wonderful aroma in your clothes. I used to go there to get whole bean pies and to avoid Bruce, because if he saw you, you were going to leave purchasing much more than you anticipated. Or a debate. 15 minutes turned into an hour and a half. Wonderful memories. Mayor Steve Shule said jokingly, apparently, I was the only one who bought books. Johnson quipped, I bought a book once when I came in for fried chicken. These good feelings, flowing from council members' memories of the bookstore, served as a prelude to their vote on January 4. Johnson, I'm glad to see it going to good use. Freelon later added, it's not just a sign or placard saying black folks were here. Black folks are here, building on a legacy, through jobs and development. But their optimism obscured an ugly series of events that shut down the bookstore years ago. The handsome brownstone was built in the 1970s as a pharmacy, owned by now retired pharmacist and jazz musician William McLaughlin, a relative of Bookman's, but it enjoyed its greatest success when it was rented by Bridges, who for 18 years operated a vibrant and profitable neighborhood center of learning, great food, and live jazz. When contacted by the Indy, Bridges was surprised to hear that Bookman and McLaughlin family were planning to open up a Checkers. He offered a cynical contrast between what used to happen at the bookstore and the proposed plans for that location. Bridges hosted a youth chess club at the bookstore that was supported by Research Triangle Park professionals, along with NC Central and area high school faculty members. Bridges said, we were teaching young people how to play chess and about its Moorish African origins. Chess is about thinking strategically and analyzing. It's like jazz. It's cerebral. The place has gone from teaching class strategically to a Checkers. Longtime residents recall a sprawling 3,000-square-foot bookstore that was a funky and fun place. Body oils commingled with the smell of fried chicken coming from the kitchen. A rockola jukebox spun out golden oldies like La La Means I Love You by the Delphonics, Misty Blue by Dorothy Moore, and Buffalo Soldier by Bob Marley. It was one of the safe spaces in the neighborhood, where thin wisps of blue smoke trailed upward from sticks of shahada, incense that could not be found anywhere else in the triangle. A college student from Duke or Central standing in a bookshelf, thumbing through a copy of J.A. Rogers' 100 Amazing Facts About the Negro, or Sheikh Anta Diop's The African Origin of Civilization, was a familiar sight. A budding, earnest young womanist might drop in to ask if your order for Bell Hook's latest book had arrived. The store's very name was inspired by the directive to know thyself, an adage that often attributed to the ancient Greeks, but that black scholars, including Bridges, say was borrowed from the ancient Egyptians. It's hard not to wonder what impact the bookstore might have had on the neighborhood if it had remained open, whether it might have inspired young people to pick up books instead of guns, possibly curbing some of the violence that has bedeviled the community in the decade since its closure. Generations of students, activists, politicians, and numerous others throughout the community would come out for the music, food, and spoken word events. Debates, workshops, and lectures featured the likes of then-relatively unknown Michael Eric Dyson, former Essence magazine editor Susan Taylor, Andrew Young, Sister Soldier H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael, and C. Eric Lincoln all lectured at the bookstore at various points, along with local luminaries like John Hope Franklin, Benjamin S. Ruffin, Jr., Howard Fuller, and the former Durham mayor, William Bill Bell. Durham native William Rogers, a professor of African and African Diaspora Studies, who recently retired from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, told the Indy, the place was a landmark. Durham lost a tremendous asset when it lost the bookstore. from 1983 throughout the 1990s, I would come to Durham two or three times a year. My first stop was always at the bookstore. Funding unanimously approved by the City Council will help jumpstart the proposed Checkers. Ironically, in 2009, discussion of a similar city financing initiative coincided with the bookstore's closure in the first place. That was the year when city officials found themselves caught in a contentious dispute between Mozilla, the building's owner, and Bridges, her tenant, who began renting the property in 1991, splitting it into three spaces for bookstore, restaurant, and a kitchen. At the center of the dispute was the city's consideration of a plan to grant Mozilla neighborhood revitalization funds to renovate the building. As previously reported in the Indy, giving the money to Mozilla would effectively squeeze out Bridges and his bookstore. Bookman recently told the Indy, however, that his family ultimately did not receive any city funds at the time. Mozilla, then 92, informed the city council that she wanted to create Moke Jazz and Cultural Center. The building would house a restaurant and two retail spaces, one potentially being a smaller version of the No. But Bridges says that in 2009, the McLaughlin family did not bother to tell him that city council members were poised to vote for money for the store, but not include me. Shortly before the meeting was set to start, he closed the bookstore early for the day and, quote, expressed his thoughts about the issue to the council members. Everyone was shocked, Bridges said to the council members, who subsequently delayed the vote. The next day, Mozilla came to the store with a letter and evicted me from the premises. They retaliated against me for speaking out. In a recent interview with Indy, Bookman praised the bookstore's contributions to the neighborhood. We, along with the entire community, very much appreciate Mr. Bridges' contributions and the time spent at this location, Bookman said in an email. We are proud to own the property and to have supported several businesses at this location over the past four decades. Bridgman tried to save his bookstore. He hired longtime Durham attorney George Exum, who filed a complaint on his behalf, accusing the McLaughlins of violating the state's Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Bridges says the case was settled out of court in 2015 when the McLaughlins agreed to a financial settlement. Exum told the Indy that the black community was outraged when Bridges was ousted from the bookstore location. He called the building of a national fast food chain a remnant of gentrification and urban colonization. Exum said there was a hidden agenda to displace a viable black business that was an asset. It's a damn shame. Bridges closed shop in April of 2010 and accepted a teaching post in North Carolina Central's political science department. He was approved for a loan that would have enabled him to move the bookstore to the old Weaver's Cleaner and Laundromat location at the north end of Fayetteville Street, he said, but the plan fell through when the place was deemed not suitable due to the cleaning chemicals that had contaminated the building. The State Employees Credit Union then offered funding to build a new bookstore from the ground up. But Bridges said, we really couldn't find a good place in the black community to break ground. He says he still wants to reopen the bookstore a decade after it closed. During last week's city council meeting, Bookman said the new $1.5 million building will have 954 feet of retail space and provide 30 full-time jobs that pay a living wage in a neighborhood that has been targeted for an economic development incentive by the city's Office of Economic and Workplace Development. Bookman noted that city staffers are endorsing a prospect that promises to bring more vitality, along with an increase in black and brown business ownership in the historic neighborhood. The fast food restaurant, he added, is also in keeping with the city's strategic economic plan of shared equity and prosperity. Bookman said that along with paying his employees a living wage, they will have health benefits. Moreover, when it comes to COVID-19 protocols, quote, Checkers really led the path by not offering indoor dining since the 1980s, he said. Councilmember Freeland noted the business could have a positive impact on the gun violence that has beset the community by providing jobs and opportunity. Quote, it's important to do economic development in the area. It's right across the street from St. Joseph's African Methodist Episcopal Church and a historic shopping center. Checkers' offer to help keep a roof over 30 future employees' heads is significant. But Councilmember Middleton remains concerned about the neighborhood's cultural history and the former bookstore's positive impact on the neighborhood. He reminded Bookman and his fellow council members that, quote, the no wasn't just about economic power, but also cultural power. And he added, that was part of the identity of the neighborhood. He then asked Bookman about his plans to allay concerns that a fast food restaurant at the location could erase a cultural footprint in the neighborhood. Bookman said that education, with NC Central and Hillside High in close proximity, is foundational for him and his family. He replied, I used to ride my bike in front of the bookstore. I'm sensitized to what it means to be a part of the community. He added he plans to open more than one Checkers. But he said, first and foremost, I want to start at this location. The priority is to be a presence in the community and continue to be part of the DNA of the community. All right, from Orange County, Sarah Pequeno's column, Price of Life. Shayna Holman anticipated a broken arm or a burnt-down office, but she never anticipated a pandemic. The Chapel Hill dentist has had her own practice for 3 years. She was committed to paying her hygienists, office workers, and assistants a living wage from the jump. If an emergency were to happen, she wanted to be able to continue paying them for up to 3 weeks while they looked for other jobs. So she saved. In March 2020, an emergency happened. Despite North Carolina never shutting down dentist offices, Holman decided that closing would be the safest option as the country learned more about COVID-19. She told her employees she continued paying them for 3 weeks while they signed up for unemployment. She also informed her clients. Holman says, I just literally wanted them to know my people were good and I was taking care of my people because that's just who I am. Holman is one of 222 businesses currently certified by Orange County Living Wage, a nonprofit that defines the wages it takes to afford to live here. On January 5, the organization announced a 2021 living wage, bumping the hourly threshold from $14.90 to $15.40. The calculation, based on the standard that only 30% of income should be used for housing, takes into account the cost it would take to rent a one-bedroom apartment in the area. Susan Romaine, the chair of Orange County Living Wage, says, since July 2009, we have had a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. For folks who are working or have families, that really is a poverty wage. We feel it's so important that as we move forward with our living wage effort, we want to continue to advocate for a minimum wage that's a living wage. North Carolina is one of 21 states that have plateaued at the federal minimum wage requirement for more than a decade. The amount may be the highest our minimum wage has ever been in the United States, but its purchasing power has decreased since the 1980s. By failing to keep up with inflation. While North Carolina's cost of living is slightly lower than the national average, the Family Success Alliance of Orange County reports that the area has the highest cost of living in the state, as well as the most income inequality. The pandemic changed the Living Wage Project's conversation this year, leaving the group to consider whether or not it should announce a new base wage for 2021 or allow a grace period. Ultimately, the group decided to continue its work, increasing the certification requirements from $14.90 an hour to $15.40, about a 3% increase. Romaine says, Our mission is devoted to living wages. We want to continue to create that awareness in the community that rent continues to go up. Other expenses continue to go up. Inflation goes up. In a way, it's more important than ever that we come out with a new living wage. For Holman and others, this means more than a certificate. It's a personal message. Excuse me. It's a personal mission, which is why she created her emergency fund. When she informed her clients that she'd continue to support them, the news spread throughout town. Holman says, people posted in the local Mother's Club about it, and there was a lot of talk around town because so many people were just kind of kicked to the curb. They were like, wow, she's really paying for them anyway. That's pretty awesome. When Home and Family Dental Care reopened after 8 weeks, she says, they were slammed with new patients who had taken notice. Because of this, Holman is sure she'll continue paying her employees a living wage, even at the higher rate, and has been able to hire more people. When a business is certified by Orange County Living Wage, they have to re-register every 2 years. Businesses that last renewed in 2019, when the living wage was set at $14.25, were expected to meet 2021's new benchmark. Despite the new minimum, the businesses have 3 months after North Carolina's state of emergency expires before they have to meet the goal. Currently, the state of emergency is set to end on March the 30th, 2021. By June 30th, the businesses would need to be up to date. Romaine says there has not been pushback based on that new living wage expectations or during the pandemic. However, some of their partners have been erased from the list, not because of opting out, but because they shuttered for good. Among them are Party Store, Balloons and Tunes, Outdoor Outfitters, Townsend, Bertram and Company, two Carborough businesses that closed after the pandemic started. Scott Connery, owner of Open Eye Cafe and Carborough Coffee Roaster, says their goal was always to pay employees a living wage. The countywide project was simply a means to verify this with the community. Their goal hasn't changed with the pandemic, but it means more spreadsheets than ever. Connery says, it's entirely stressful, and we worry about it every day, and I lose sleep, and I've gotten a couple of ulcers. It's horrible. That is not an easy thing to do, period. Especially for a small business that's running on slim margins. But now, during a pandemic, when everyone's revenue is slashed at least 50% and sometimes more, it's a real mission. You gotta dig in and figure it out. And we're pulling out all the stops to make it happen. Orange County Living Wage factors in the cost of living for four counties. Instead of just Orange, they look at Alamance, Chatham, and Durham. They have to, because so many people can't afford to live in Chapel Hill or the immediate surrounding area. Romaine says, even at $15.40, there is no cushion in this budget. It's a very tight budget, and it is just for that one-bedroom apartment. Connery and Holman both say that these minimums are just that, the minimum. Holman says, you want your employees to feel supported, encouraged, and empowered, and the way to do that is not by saying, get off the clock, or I don't really care if they have health insurance or not, or I don't really care if they have a retirement plan or not. I really want my employees to know I care about them as people, I care about their future and their health, and I'm wanting to make that personal sacrifice for my own income and make sure that they are good. That's just important. Melba Newsom writes a story that was originally published by NC Health News called Shut Out. When I first became interested in taking part in a coronavirus vaccine trial, I assumed all I had to do was step forward. I believed that the same characteristics that raised my coronavirus risk, black, over 60, type 2 diabetic, also made me highly sought after as a volunteer, but it wasn't nearly that easy. North Carolina was one of the first states to release coronavirus data by race. The numbers from Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, where I live, showed the disparate impact of the virus on people of color and were soon confirmed by the skyrocketing COVID rates in other cities with high black populations. Then the myth began circulating on social media that black people were somehow immune to the disease. In one day, five different people sent me a link to the Plandemic conspiracy theory video. I could see how the black community's justified skepticism about public health initiatives would exacerbate the health crisis we were facing. Last summer, vaccine manufacturers Pfizer and Moderna announced they would recruit 60,000 participants, 18 years and older, from all genders and racial and ethnic groups for their late-stage clinical trials. Volunteering was a way to ensure that black people were adequately represented in the research and to demonstrate that the vaccine is safe for my community. While some people thanked me for being willing to risk my personal safety to advance medical science, others expressed surprise and even outrage. How could I offer myself up as a human guinea pig to the very medical establishment that alternates between ignoring and exploiting black people? I asked rhetorically in response, without guinea pigs, where would we be? A Washington Post poll conducted in the spring of 2020 found that more than 30% of black people personally knew someone who had died from COVID-19. Yet a December 2020 Pew Research Center found that only 42% of black adults said they would be willing to receive the vaccine, down 2 points from a survey taken in mid-June. Black people have many reasons to distrust a public health system that has used our bodies for experimentation without care or consent. But given the coronavirus impact on the black community, informed participation in clinical trials is essential to ensure that the vaccine works, regardless of age, gender, and ethnic background. Little has passed since 1993 when Congress passed the National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act, which requires federally funded research projects to include women and minorities in their trials. Yet the numbers appear to be headed in the wrong direction. People of color account for fewer than 10% of patients enrolled in clinical trials, according to the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities. There has been a long-standing assumption that the problem lies in minorities' distrust of the medical establishment due to historic mistreatment during the Tuskegee study and the eugenics movement. While lack of trust is a factor, a recent study published by the American Cancer Society journals found bias among healthcare professionals as a contributing factor, too. Some study recruiters perceived race as irrelevant when screening and recruiting potential participants. Others not only viewed racial and ethnic minorities as less promising participants, but reported withholding trial opportunities from minorities based on those false perceptions. Pfizer and Moderna touted diversity as a priority for their phase 3 vaccine trials. I responded to several solicitations looking for volunteers in the Charlotte area, feeling confident I would be picked. If selected, I would receive 2 shots, an initial vaccine or placebo, then a booster or placebo about a month later. I would be required to document any side effects from the vaccination in an electronic diary. These side effects commonly include pain or soreness near the injection site, headaches, muscle aches, fatigue, and fevers. My white friends, Anita and Lucia, were both selected for the Pfizer trial. Lucia, a retired manufacturing executive, was recruited because she was in their database after participating in a study for people with celiac disease a year earlier. Anita, a psychology professor, told me she wanted to put her body on the line to help others. Anita believes she got the vaccine and not a placebo because she developed a mild fever the day after her first injection, 99.5 to 100. I usually don't run fevers and haven't had one since, she says. Lucia thinks she got the placebo because she had no side effects after her shot. As I stood by for the call that never came in early October, Moderna announced that it had failed to recruit enough Black, Latinx, and Native American participants in its study. To make up for the shortfall, the firm slowed enrollment and instructed research centers to increase participation among minority volunteers. Frustrated, I applied again, clearly identifying myself as Black this time, and waited. Still nothing. I wasn't willing to give up, but clearly this was going to be much harder than I imagined. And now our cover story, Mayoral Ambition. Jane Porter writes this interview. Terrence Ruth, 37, a lecturer at NC State School of Social Work and executive director of the Justice Love Foundation, a nonprofit that raises money for social justice causes, threw his hat into the race for Raleigh's top elected office against Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. We spoke to Ruth about his reasons for running, top priorities, and a vision for a more engaged Raleigh. And this article is written in question and answer style. Indy. What specific policy disagreements do you have with current Mayor Baldwin that prompted you to run for the seat? My entry into the race is not about the current mayor, but because I have seen the slow dissolving of public trust in our city. From how the protest was handled, to how the Downtown South project was passed, to the removal of the CACs, that's Citizen Advisory Councils, with very little input from the community. In order for us to be a healthy city and continue to be a healthy city, we have to be in touch and in proximity with and to lean on the people we are serving. That is the most critical. All ideas sit on that public trust. All vision, all policy, all missions, all principles for the city must sit on the idea of sustaining and improving public trust. Without that foundation, it's really difficult to be successful. You've laid out ways you feel the council could do better in addressing Downtown South, including providing transparency around how opportunity zone tax breaks could benefit nearby residents, helping to develop a community benefits agreement, and improving communication with stakeholders. Is there a scenario in which you could support Downtown South? Community engagement is something we accept in any other industry, so when we talk about human-centered design and you see companies provide pre-products to the customer base to see if they would accept it or like it, we accept that practice. If you look at research, the best practice is a strong community engagement. The Downtown South Project is not something that is unattractive because it is the Downtown South Project. What I heard in the community is, can we be a part of this? Can we come to agreements? Can we be included, not just in the final stages, but can we build something this size together? This is not a unique request. There are cities that are doing this well. Oakland's Department of Transportation just created equity indicators, and those equity indicators drove how they planned, who they included, how they made decisions, the timetable, what was relevant and sufficient for the city's needs. What I'm asking for is not even for innovation. There are best practices across the country. Downtown South could have used an improved and strong community engagement from start to finish. That project is more the icing on the cake than it is a project that stands alone. If you look through this first year, from protests against the project to the Planning Commission's vote that stood in opposition to the Council's vote, to that continuous debate over what is replacing community engagement platforms, it's a culmination of disconnection between community and city leadership that would make it very hard to salvage any healthy communication. Someone coming in with a fresh idea, a fresh way to engage community, starting with community and building trust, new leadership would have a better slate in terms of building public trust and community engagement and rebuilding that relationship between developers, investors, city leadership, businesses, and community. That is where my strengths lie. At the moment, I think it would be very difficult to walk down that road because of the social capital that has been lost throughout that year. Over the years, council members have held differing views about the rate and scale at which Raleigh should grow. You've asked how we can rectify this council's commitment to unbridled growth when downtown businesses are dissolving and families are living in motels. Where do you fall, ideologically, on the question of growing the city? From my experience in engaging community, we have tough times ahead in terms of rebuilding our city and recovering from the damage of closed businesses, people out of work, people who are going to be evicted from their homes. There is something about growing as a united Raleigh. When I sat in community meetings, I didn't hear too much of a voice that says, no, don't build, don't grow. And for those who are building, I didn't hear that, we don't want to be inclusive and equitable. I didn't hear a purist at all on either side. What I heard in discussions about Downtown South was a united group saying, let's grow, but let's grow with balance. Let's grow where we have more opportunities to talk, not just with council members and the mayor, but also with each other. With that, there is accountability on both sides, so that we're building with existing residents in mind and we're growing with new residents in mind. And how do we grow and stay attractive? I heard a balanced conversation, not one side or the other, as it's neatly placed in theoretical terms in articles. I heard a call for balance. You've criticized the council for abolishing citizen advisory councils, also known as CACs. If elected, would you act to restore CACs, or are there better ways to engage residents? The CACs, in my opinion, are symbolic of trust between the public and city leadership. I would center on what the best way is to reestablish public trust. I would do that with guiding principles. Any conversation about community engagement must have diversity, equity, and inclusion as its element. My plan is to walk in the first 100 days with a strategy to engage the community deeply, to meet the stakeholders, and to design an approach that meets every resident, not just those who can attend a meeting at night, but also those who can only engage virtually, or those who may not be able to attend a meeting and may need to watch later. My desire is to create a community engagement platform that takes the rich history of the CACs and also leans on the richness of the technology we have in the triangle. The goal would be to establish equity. And the way I define that means that everyone would have what they need today while considering how resources have been distributed in the past. And that is hard, as equity means providing what is truly needed for anyone in any situation to have access to options that allow them to live and move freely and flourish. For that to be accomplished, the city must know what that is for the community. We must maintain diversity. To do that, we need to have a large and representative population engage in our discussions and decisions. So, we need to ensure representation from a collection of people that represents our city, from race to class, to religion, to abilities, to gender, to just make sure these are important and that we design community engagement with these in mind. The pillar that is most important will set the base of our conversation about the Downtown South project is inclusion. It is one thing to say you're at the table. It's another to say you actually have true decision-making power. People who make the organization more diverse should also be allowed to participate to lead in the decision-making process. There is value in being informed by community itself. How do you think the council will implement recommendations that come out of that ongoing community engagement study? I am confident in the researcher. I have talked with Mickey Fearn. He is a solid thinker and innovator. This is not so much on him as it is on the leadership. When you talk about the city leadership, you also have to talk about the perception or the public trust that may exist to exercise this in a meaningful way. That is in question, and I think the community will provide the final answer to whether this will be successful or not. What, if any, reforms should the city make to the police department and the way law enforcement is conducted in Raleigh? We must first look at leadership in terms of how it is facilitating relationships with the police department itself and how it is leveraging that relationship to connect bridges between the police department and the community. Again, this is not an area where we need innovation. There are cities and police departments that have best practices. I sat on a panel for compassionate policing where there were police departments with amazing models that center community voice and community leaders. They hired community leaders, not in uniform, to inform the police as to what's going on in the community. And they also have compassionate police officers dressed in regular clothes who have offices embedded in their community. We don't have to be innovators in this conversation. We lean on existing strategies and see what would be best practiced here in Raleigh. But that takes leadership and a vision to create a strong relationship between community and policing. Raleigh has an opportunity. I can lead that conversation to create a strong relationship between the police department and the city. I'm not seeing a reluctant audience on either side. How is the city doing on transit? If there's room for improvement, what would you recommend? There have been great strides in terms of the conversation around bike safety, bike transportation, walkways. We can also improve, number one, in how we are engaging those who don't have access to transportation. So where are our bus routes? Can we exist in a city that has no bus fees? There are already groups advocating for the removal of bus fees and reallocating funds to support that idea. It's going back to those pillars of equity, diversity, and inclusion. When we are thinking about transportation and planning, do we have people who are impacted most in these meetings? Again, there are cities who are designing their decision-making, planning around the schedules of those most impacted and incorporating a larger group of people. There are ways we can improve in that area. An $80 million affordable housing bond referendum passed in a landslide this fall, but most agree it will only scratch the surface in addressing affordable housing. What more can be done? I'm organizing a group right now to look at what it means to address those who make less than 30% of the area median income with private investment to see how we can make a difference in homelessness. COVID has left a number of people who will be impacted. Renters no longer being able to afford to rent. Homeowners no longer being able to afford their homes. Those who are in hotels that are now at capacity and those who are already homeless. We are looking at a model of faith-based affordable housing. A national organization has been meeting with us to try to get private investors at the table. So, we have private investors, donors, and religious leaders, a mixture of audiences. We want that direction because we found a majority of the property owned in most cities is owned by religious institutions. There is an opportunity there to make an impact on affordable housing by partnering with religious institutions that already have property in prime locations or buildings that could be repurposed. Also, these religious institutions are traditionally providing services to these same populations. So we're trying to have a meaningful conversation around affordable housing to really eradicate homelessness in Raleigh with dignity. We're trying to figure out ways to supplement the $80 million. We know it will not be enough. Raleigh is a place people want to live. It's a wonderful place to live, but we know that's not the case for everyone. But the people who have homes, who are comfortable and doing well, a lot of them care and would like to leverage their resources to help families in need. A committee is currently studying proposed changes to the council, including longer term lengths, staggered elections, and making council positions full-time and paying accordingly. Would you support any of these changes? There are pros and cons to each proposal. Obviously, the wonderful benefit of the existing model is that you are more accountable because you have to turn around and show the city you're working on its behalf in order to be elected again. The pros of longer terms is you get to work on systemic long-term impact projects with the same team for a longer period of time. I would love to hear further discussions on where the committee is leaning in that conversation. Are there policy decisions this council has made with which you agree? Allowing accessory dwelling units by right and starting the police advisory board with the individuals who were involved with organizing the protest this summer. I thought that was a good idea. So those are two areas. Finally, is there anything else you want Raleigh residents to know about your campaign for mayor? I'm focused, number one, on just baseline strengthening our community engagement. It's not an easy project, but it is fundamental to launching anything else. My goals and vision start there. After that, I want to make sure we are able to engage all of Raleigh around affordable housing. That will be a critical conversation, especially post-COVID. The final thing is really beefing up our support for small businesses all across the city, but particularly downtown. I think we can do more in terms of an experience around shopping local in Raleigh that will drive shoppers back to downtown and back to local shops. Small business is a reflection of our community. That's where we hire local residents, where people make their livings and invest in Raleigh. So we need a healthy, small business community, and my energy will go into those three pockets. Well, for my limited time left on today's broadcast, a food and drink article called Mock Trial by Lee Taus again about spending a dry January. As the days shortened and darkened with the 2020's final act, I found my nightly glass of wine coming earlier and becoming two or three, sometimes chased by shame the next morning. A disclaimer, I don't see drinking as a black and white divide between good, self-controlled, responsible drinkers and bad, glutinous alcoholics. Everyone who chooses to imbibe exists on a spectrum of risk, and where you fall depends on your relationship with alcohol. I've always liked to drink, although since college, my relationship with alcohol has mellowed. Pre-pandemic, I'd go out and throw a few back once a week with pals, but for the most part, I felt in control, until I didn't. So like many folks, I committed myself to a dry January this year. It's something I've done the last few years, sometimes with a no-drink November thrown in, as a personal health challenge. I see it as a reset, to remember how my body feels at 100 and discover if my constant morass has been a perpetual, low-grade hangover. I didn't intend to put down the bottle forever, but my liver was asking for a month off. I was off to a strong start, feeling more awake, more productive, just more. But then, last week, right-wing terrorists stormed the Capitol. I found myself paralyzed in front of CNN, eyeing the cabinet and telling myself a whiskey shot wouldn't be so bad. It wasn't terrible, but it also wasn't great. Even without the pandemic, January is also notoriously not great for the restaurant industry, as liquor is one of the most lucrative menu items. For Raleigh chef Scott Crawford, the solution is to keep a mix of booze-free options on the menu all year round, an ever-changing slate of creative concoctions that aim to complete what's on the plate as much as a cocktail would. Our basic philosophy is that anyone who comes to our restaurant and chooses not to partake in spirits should still have the same excitement about what it is that they're drinking, Crawford says. So I'm going to curtail this article and cut to the chase. Lee Toss goes to Crawford's Person Street restaurant to give mocktails an honest go. The goal of the mocktail menu, which is constantly evolving, is to provide patrons with a booze-free treat as complex and thought-provoking as anything else on the menu. It's all about balance in both life and drinks. So, the first mocktail that beverage manager Joseph Jordan slides me is a savory drink infused with smoked golden beets and a bit of vinegar capped with a sprig of thyme. The champagne vinegar provides the same tingly kick you'd usually get from vodka or gin, but it also makes you slow down and savor every sip. The next mix I try is a sweet combination of roasted apples and cinnamon that, if I'm honest, doesn't strike me as terribly different from a shot of Fireball cinnamon whiskey in cider, but it's light enough to serve as a perfect aperitif or digestive, bracketing a meal. The final mocktail is the most mind-blowing, an Aleppo pepper-infused tropical snowstorm. It's a panna cotta-themed painkiller with notes of fruit and pie crust in every sip, topped by a frothy, emulsified, snow-like foam sprinkled with pepper flakes. It's spicy, sweet, and utterly unique. In a perfect dish, one element can't overpower, and it's the interplay of flavors that elevates even the smallest bite. Here, a beet is more than a beet. It's a symphony. Perhaps that's what I'd been looking for during my temporary sobriety. Something to balance out the bitterness, but also make me ask the hard questions, evaluate my relationships and goals, and hopefully adjust accordingly. And just like taste, our needs change over time, writes Lee Toss. Now, I've missed the opportunity to read about Alan Gurganis, author, newest short story collection by Sarah Edwards, and a book, a short column, a sidebar column, by the book, the local releases coming in 2021, novels, poetry, and nonfiction, etc. And a couple of other articles in there, which can certainly be found online from indieweek.com, which is free. And I hope I'll be able to read some more, maybe some of those, next week. And as I depart, we have only to thank our taped Ars Gratis, our free online contributors for our music segment. And just to remind everybody that this broadcast will be available shortly as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. Just go to the podcast section and click it. And we will look to hearing you and hearing me next week on Indie Week. So long.